Welcome to the Millennial Therapist Podcast with Mao and Nao.
This podcast is hosted by two millennial therapists who are true crime, forensic psychology, and macabre obsessed.
This is not your typical mental health podcast where only mental health and social work topics are discussed. We dabble in various topics from cultural humility to military mental health to ghosts to interesting ways our parents use the paranormal to discipline us. Ed Kukui, anyone?
Why so many topics? Because we're millennials. To make things more interesting, one is an Air Force veteran and a mom of two. The other is currently serving active duty, and both are children of immigrants working to honor their ancestors.
What's up, homies? Thank you for joining us at MTP with Mao and Nao, your favorite millennial therapists and queens of the dark abyss. If this is your first time, welcome. Please subscribe and stay a while if you're returning. Hey, we love your beautiful face and you smell amazing. This is Nao and that's Mao. We're going to talk about the tragic murders of Shanann Watts, Bella Marie Watts, and Catherine CC Watts. Trigger warning, this episode includes details about murder, violence, and child abuse. So before we get started, we just want to say that this case is very complex, so me and Mao decided to take a different approach today and just kind of take more of a discussion approach as we kind of came out about a lot of sources that had a lot of information. Some of these sources are newspaper articles or interviews or documentaries that we found, but also a book called Letters from Chris Watts. We'll include those links in the description. So me and Mao are kind of just going to talk over some of the information that we have. We'd love to hear from you. Okay, let's get started a little bit with who Chris and Shanann were. Chris Watts and Shanann Catherine Watts were natives of Spring Lake in Aberdeen, North Carolina. They initially met in 2010 and were married in Mecklenburg County on November 3rd, 2012. They actually met through a friend who had kind of set them up. In one of her Facebook videos, she has said, "I got a friend request from Chris on Facebook, and I was like, what the heck? I'm never going to meet him, except. And one thing led to another, and 8 years later, we have two kids. We live in Colorado, and he's the best thing that's ever happened to me." One of the things that we found more about the family is that Shanann had lupus, an autoimmune disease that causes a person's body to attack its own organs, according to this news article. They did have two daughters, Bella Marie Watts, who was born on December 17, 2013, and Celeste Catherine, or Cece Watts, born July 17, 2015. They lived in a five-bedroom home in Frederick, Colorado, that they had purchased in 2013, and eventually the family did declare bankruptcy in 2015. Chris was employed by Anadarko Petroleum as an operator, and he had started this job back in January 2015, and Shanann was a representative for the health and wellness company Level, selling a product called Thrive. It was later learned that at the time of her death, she was 15 weeks pregnant with a son who they were planning to name Nicole Lee Watt. And that's a little bit of background on the family.
And I did want to, I don't know if we address it later in here, but Shanann's job was with Level, selling Thrive, which is actually an MLM, multi-level marketing product. So she was involved with this. So, I mean, it doesn't make a huge play to it, but it might. I don't know how much of that financial burden caused the murder, but with, you know, MLMs, we all know the stress levels that come from doing a job that essentially has no boundaries, right? Like, you're expected to be on the phone or on your phone, social media, doing all of this. And a lot of times you put a lot of money into these products and your quote-unquote business with not a lot of payout. So I think that goes into that filing bankruptcy, because they're also living above their means too, because Chris was the only working parent, so he was bringing in the income, and I think they were perpetuating a lifestyle that they couldn't necessarily afford either, especially with her being in the public eye so much, being on Facebook and kind of having to live up to this persona that was, or MLM employees get caught up in. So I just wanted to make a note of that. So in Nao mentioned, with a combined income of $90,000 in 2014, in addition to credit card debt, student loans, medical bills, the couple filed for bankruptcy in 2015, stating that their $3,000 mortgage and $600 car payment took most of their $4,900 monthly expenses. And additionally, their homeowners association was suing them for unpaid HOA fees, which makes the mortgage even more. So that was a lot of debt. May 5th, 2018, Shanann posted a sweet Facebook Live video that was 31 minutes long, musing about her family life, saying that she loves waking up on Saturdays and being able to enjoy her family, and talking about being excited about the upcoming summer in Colorado, saying, "I believe that everything in life happens for a reason, and I also believe people are placed in our life for a reason." Chris was in the video not participating actively, but he was like playing with the girls in the background. And then June 11th, 2018, Shanann surprises Chris with the news that they're expecting a baby, where Shanann wears a shirt that says, "Oops, we did it again." And his reaction essentially seemed positive, saying, "That's awesome." And then June 14, 2018, the way they write this is so interesting. It's so like dramatic. Chris enters co-worker Nicole contact. So essentially June 14, 2018, Chris meets Nicole Kissinger, a co-worker who also becomes his mistress or side piece. A couple days later.
And I just want to say the book that we're referencing is Letters from Christopher, The Tragic Confessions. The Tragic Confessions of the Watts Family Murders, and this is authored by Shirlene Cadle and Christopher Watts. And essentially what the author describes is that even since adolescence, he was described more as like shy and to himself. And so mentoring a relationship or his marriage with Shanann, being on the spotlight and being posted on about, wasn't something necessarily that he was comfortable with. And so especially oftentimes, it sounded like a lot of the times that he was included on social media content, he was kind of like sporadic. So he was just
around
in there, you know, not really. So I guess that was another thing that was pointed out in the book.
Yeah, and the dynamic too, I think, is interesting to, because he was not as public as she was. So I wonder if there was any conflict with that of like her wanting him to be more involved in the public eye. And he's like, "I don't care. I don't want to be part of that." Yeah, there's a lot of unknown stuff between their marital relationship. So he meets Nicole 2018 June, and after a month of like texting back and forth, they meet up outside of the office, right? So essentially like for a date. And according to the Denver Post, Chris sees Nicole 4 or 5 times a week, and they start a physical relationship, so that like affair. But he tells her he's almost divorced. And then when the girls, Shanann and the girls, are out of town in North Carolina, he tells Nicole that the divorce is final. So he's straight up just telling her some shit, not being honest.
Yeah, and all the while, Shanann is like praising him for the kind of husband and father he is. According to a HuffPost article, on Father's Day, Shanann writes a tribute to her husband on Facebook, which says, "Chris, we are so incredibly blessed to have you. You do so much every day for us and take such great care of us. You are the reason I was brave enough to agree to number 3. And at this point, she's referring to the child that she had become pregnant with. On June 19th, she goes to share a picture from her first ultrasound on Facebook, adding that her husband is the best dad us girls could ask for. As Mao said, they go on a trip to North Carolina, in which Shanann takes Bella and Celeste for a 5-week vacation. Krista stays back at home and works. And he actually doesn't join them until the very last week of the trip. One of the Frederick police officers had written in a report that while in North Carolina, Shanann called a friend and said that Chris wouldn't touch her or kiss her anymore. Shanann had told her that Chris didn't want the baby she was pregnant with and that he was scared. He was happy with having only the 2 girls. Things kind of start unraveling more with Nicole. On July 4th, Kissinger goes to Chris's house for the first time to, quote-unquote, set up his diet and weight loss and exercise goals, is what she had later told police. Which is interesting because Like, this is a married man with children, and maybe she was under the guise of, like, you know, they're divorcing and they're separating. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just completely inappropriate, just given, like, the state of his marriage, the fact that he still has this life with the family life.
Right.
What gets cited in the article is that he invited her to his home, he cooked lunch, they ate, and she left. But Chris later told a different story to investigators on February 2019. He said he woke up at Kessinger's home on the morning of July 4th to several calls, missed calls from his wife. He said he told Nicole he needed to go home in case that his wife called back and that Nicole had gotten upset. At this point, I guess she had made the realization that she would always be, quote-unquote, the other person, and that he would continue to put his wife first. He told the investigators that she told him it would be best if they didn't see each other for the rest of the day, but then later had invited him back to her house. It's kind of like these things are kind of unraveling. More and more tensions are kind of building up, right? And this case, because of how bizarre and just tragic and sad, we kind of had to work like our way backwards and kind of trying to find, like, understand how things like this happen.
Right.
So some signs of tension just began to show. And one of the text messages that they found on July 10, 2018 was with Shannon asking, "What's you okay? It's like you don't want to talk. I kept trying to talk and I had to dig it out of you." To which Chris replies with, "I'm fine, baby. The last few days at work have put a lot of responsibility on me with new people. I didn't mean to seem short, boo. I love you to the moon and back, heart." And that looks like a kissy emoji. Then Shannon responds with saying, "I miss you and I feel like you just want to work out and run." Chris claimed that running helps clear his head and it's a way to free it all. She didn't buy that excuse and she told him, "I wish my husband wanted to talk to me." And so this is from a transcription of those text messages being exchanged.
And I think in this timeline, looking at another source, biography.com, this is when him and Cole were going on more dates together, right? So it's July. They go on, like, museums. He spends a night with her at Great Sand Dunes National Park while his family is away. Even before going to join his family, he gives her a love note. Like, just so shady. And, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, and then, like, go on trips and, mm-hmm. like, they take pictures. And yes. It's like he's a single man with no family.
Right, and this was only a month within them, quote unquote, dating. He, like, fell in lust with her, right? Right? Is that when he met her? 2018?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he met her in June, and then they started dating.
Yeah, that they're married.
You know, in that first, whatever, first month, honeymoon stage.
It's bizarre, and just, either way. So, you know, I guess Shannon and the girls are still in North Carolina, so he meets up with them the last week of their trip. So the source goes on to say that Chris flies to North Carolina for the final week. The reunion with his family is not happy, according to a transcript of text that Shannon had sent to Chris, who she then sent to a friend later. And so Shannon goes on to say, "Truth came out last night. I didn't create no dagger between you and your dad. That was done by your mom and your dad, and I won't change a thing. My daughter's life is way more important, and you better believe I wanted to say a whole lot more than I did. But I was being a bigger person and protecting Bella. I didn't tell your dad not to come to the party. I didn't tell him not to text or call your daughter or her birthday. I didn't tell him to start acting like he only has two grandkids instead of four. I didn't block your family on Facebook. He did. Myself and your kids have nothing to say to them. They do. They owe your kids their life. Your parents' home isn't a safe zone. Your mom isn't safe. You can let them tell you what you want, but I didn't tell anyone to stop loving your kids or stop acting like it. He did that. He did that, not me." There's, like, more to like, the text messages. Mm-hmm. And it goes on to say, like, on August 4th, what had happened was that, I guess, Shannon sends Chris a long text accusing him of failing to stand up for her after his parents exposed their daughter, Celeste, to Nuss, which she is, in fact, allergic to. We won't read all of it, but she says things like, "I don't ever want to hear, 'I'm sorry I killed your kid because I was stupid. That would kill me. These kids are my world, and I have to protect them from the evil of the world.'" She says, "From the day I left, you never said I missed you both. I missed you before I said it. Something changed when I left. You may be happier alone, and that's fine. You can be alone. This pregnancy, you have failed to acknowledge it or to acknowledge how I'm feeling. The first trimester is the scariest and most dangerous, yet we can we lose this baby at any point till delivery, I'm not going to be treated this way for having the balls to protect our family and kids. I should get a gold ducking medal for handling in the way I did. And so there's a lot more family strain aside from what's just going on mm-hmm. within the couple dynamic here.
Mm-hmm.
This continues on. Mm-hmm. And Shannon appears to have a fight with her in-laws, and this prompted them to skip Zillis' birthday party that summer. She's telling a friend about what happened. She says, "What did he say in regards to Chris?" And she said, "Nothing." She says, "Nothing at all?" And Shannon says, "Just that he loves the kids." "Did he say that he loves you?" "No. He asked me if kids could see his parents, and I said no. I'm standing my ground. They haven't made contact in 4 weeks. No show to her party. Nothing said for her party." And so, you know, things are just kind of like escalating and just kind of becoming very, very tense with the family altogether.
Yeah. And that makes me wonder, too, is how much his parents were in his ear about being with Shannon, too. I would doubt that he told them about his new girlfriend, because obviously that's him like admitting that he's having an affair. But and I think this was even before this situation, Shannon never really got along with his mother. Watching Bailey Sarian's episode on this on YouTube, she had a lot more information regarding their relationship. And what she had mentioned was that Chris's mom didn't like Shannon for the sole reason that Shannon was taking away her only baby, or her son that she loved so much. Like, this is a grown-ass dude. Like, what the fuck? That I don't understand, that dynamic. Maybe I do. I don't know. I'm not getting into that. I'm not a family therapist like that. But he's grown up. Like, stop.
And he's making his choices. Like, he chose to marry this woman. Like, nobody held him at gunpoint. And which is interesting because...
And she's resenting her. And she's resenting Shannon for
she's
it.
She's, like, triangulating Shannon into her son's choices.
Yes.
And it's so... It's interesting because I think in the Netflix documentary, like, they show footage of the video of the wedding. Mm. And it's the opposite. Shannon's brother and father are both in tears because they feel very grateful of the kind of man that is going to become her husband.
That's right. And for the mom from the get-go saw Chris as somebody that did no wrong. I think from that documentary, too, they had talked about him being, like, essentially, like, sheltered, and his mom, like, making it seem like he did no wrong ever. I think there was some other childhood stuff. This is my opinion, allegedly, right? Like, not saying his mom created a killer, but I think we, looking at the lack of accountability and that grandiose sense of entitlement that he had, that he could have this affair and treat his family like shit, essentially, was perpetuated early on in childhood. Kind of like Casey Anthony, you know, that parallel really spoke to me in regards of like that narcissism, and we'll talk about that too, but yeah.
Yeah, and I was trying to find a book somewhere where it sounds like Shannon understands that Chris doesn't want to have a third baby because he's scared to have a third one. But in reality, the way the book talks about letters from Chris is that, in fact, what was happening is that he had already fantasized of a different and new life with Nicole. So the only thing standing in his way was the family that he had helped create.
Right.
And the book had said it, like, perfectly, the way that he felt about it. On August 4th, it's on the timeline, it notes that while Chris is away, Kessinger searches for wedding dresses on the internet for over 2 hours, according to a review of her cell phone data. And then she actually tried. She had initially told, I think, police officers, or it's in the reports that she had denied that she knew that he was married. But when they had reviewed her cell phone data, they had found that she had, in fact, Googled Chris and Shannon. And then this comes up where she looks up for wedding dresses for 2 hours.
Yeah.
So, you know, in this, like, day and age, I feel like that's kind of common in our generation to try to look somebody up.
To Google each other, like, absolutely. You know,
that's yeah. Funny. Like your Facebook, your Insta, yeah. Your Twitter,
right.
Your LinkedIn. I don't know. Even, like, on Venmo, I've heard people look each other up. Yeah, you hear all kinds of things in therapy.
Dang.
So...
That's smart.
So, yeah.
Like, what are you paying for?
Right? Like,
what are you setting money for?
Why are you going to coffee and who are you getting it with?
Right. What's that emoji mean, fucker?
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting that that also had come out in regards to Nicole, because so far the stance has been that she has not had nothing to do with what ended up unraveling.
Yeah.
So on August 7th, Shanann confides in friends about her marital problems. And so what she said is that Chris told me last night he's scared to death about this his third baby, and he's happy with just Belle and Celeste and doesn't want another baby. And the friend tells her he's just scared. Everything will be fun once the baby comes. And then Shanann says, Addie, he has changed. I don't know who he is. And then the friend goes on to say, fine, not fun. What do you mean? He hasn't touched me all week, kissed me, talked to me, except for when I'm trying to figure out what is wrong. Mm. And in the book, it does detail that part of the reason why is because he's spending a lot of time with Nicole, mm-hmm. but also spending a lot of time thinking about her and fantasizing about this new life. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, he had to kind of start detaching himself, becoming distant from the very things that are competing needs and interest. The friend's like, what? That doesn't sound like Chris. Did he go to the appointment? And she says, yes, but cold. Addie, I have no idea what happened. Mm. And then the friend says, go through his phone. Make sure there isn't some other I have to kill. Actually, can we bleep that? Sorry. I try not to say the bad words. It says, this is a total left field. And then, you know, the friend tries to be helpful. Why not go to counseling? Totally is out of left field. Mm. He said he's not sitting on no damn couch saying what he just said to me to no stranger. And the friend says, oh, Jesus.
Wow. Can we talk about how much of a piece of shit he is? Even if he didn't kill his family, his wife is being so vulnerable to him and really asking, she's like begging for some type of connection or even just like explanation. And he sits there and says that to her, like, that's not anything anybody deserves at all. I said it. Fuck you, Chris.
Yeah, and then, you know, taking from the book, it says, Shanann had actually mailed Chris a book in hopes that it would kind of help with their marriage. And he ended up just throwing it in the garbage. And it goes on to quote, Christopher realized that the day that he could not have Nikki and his family at the same time. It was the first time he realized it. It was time to get rid of what was standing in the way of his and Nikki's being together. And he could make that happen. He had his nerve up, but the nerve he had was not to talk to his wife about their problems, mm-hmm. but to kill her. It's just sad and so tragic that this kind of leads up to how things kind of escalated. They talk about him being cold, the ultrasound, and so kind of like the way she's sensing her spouse. They ended up deciding to cancel the baby gender reveal party because how things are so strange right now. So on August 9th, Shanann leaves for a business trip to Arizona, and on the way there, she tells a friend that she had the best talk yet with Chris the night before. And what was actually said, I'm not really sure what they had talked about. And I might have not been able to have found it in the book, but it sounded like she had some kind of resolve from the conversation that she felt kind of good about it. So who knows? And so if you do have a source or something, please let us know, because I'd be interested to see what the conversation is. But on that same day, Shanann texts a friend a handwritten letter she drafted to her husband. And in this letter, she is quoted saying she doesn't know how they fell out of compatibility, which is something that she's quoting him about that he had said previously. And there's the handwritten letter, and she pretty much expresses, like, I don't know where to begin. I am so lost for words, I can even explain how hard this pain is. The last 5 weeks have been the hardest. I missed everything about you. I missed your morning breath, your touch, your lips and kisses. I missed holding you. And then she goes towards the end of the letter, it says, I really don't know how, quote, we fell out of compatibility. Or if there is some, or that if it's someone else's words. The only thing that changed this month was everything going down with your family. I can't change what happened, but I can try to work things out with you and with them. But there has to be a mutual respect for everyone. I definitely deserve an apology because of Celeste. I can suck up her going against everything I said to our kids,
but our daughter's life. So she's pretty much setting down like a pretty hard boundary of like, I'm willing to work on the marriage and I'm willing to reconcile with your family. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to my baby's life, like that's not something that I'm willing to risk or joke about.
Right. Right. While she's, you know, writing this letter and life-changing event and transition situation, I mean, like her world is changing, right? They've been married for 7 years and about to have a third, and homeboy is, while she's out on a business trip, he hires a babysitter and says he's going to a Colorado Rockies game with his coworker. In fact, he takes Nicole out on a date to a sports bar in Erie, Colorado. So while he was out on his date with his side piece, Shanann wrote to her friend Addie explaining that, so she sent her a text to say, hey, this is what I'm going to tell Chris tomorrow night. So the message read, in quotes, "Can you please tell me something? Because just like you, I'm in my head. I try to fix things and make them better, and this is making me crazy. I know that you need time. I want to give you what you're asking for and respect your space. I need some time. This place that I'm in my head, is not a good place. It is not healthy for me or Nico. I need you to help me help you. I need you to give just a little bit of what I did or didn't do, so I'm not going crazy in my head to figure it out. I know I can't fix this by myself, that we are going to have to work together." So in this text, it seems like he had not asked for a divorce. They hadn't talked about getting a divorce. It's essentially, he's just saying, I need time. Not confronting her, right? Like, not being real with her and saying, like, I don't want to be with you anymore. I'm cheating on you. I got a girlfriend. He just keeps stringing her along because he is being a coward and not telling her how he truly feels. I imagine even in the text that we read out earlier, he's just like, nothing's wrong, babe. Work is just really stressful for me. Like, yeah, so he's trash. So then we're going to go into the disappearance and essentially the really sad part of this whole story. So Shanann returned home from a training or conference that she went to in Arizona with her friend, and she arrived around almost 2 at like 1:48 in the morning on August 13, 2018. Her friend Nicole had dropped her off, and you can see footage of her, I think, returning through one of like the doorbell camera. So Chris was home with the kids at that time. So her friend Nicole, the same girl, the same home girl that I expect all y'all to be like when I go missing, texted her in the morning, I think, and was like, hey, did you make it in time to your appointment? Because she had a baby appointment that morning, and because it was so late, she like hit her up around maybe 8 or something, was like, hey, did you make it to your appointment? And Shanann never texted back. Maybe even just a couple hours, Nicole's like, that's not normal for her to not text me back or even say anything, because she's always on her phone, right? Like, that's her job or her work is through that. So Nicole went to Chris's house to look around to see if there was anybody there, and there was no response. So she called Chris, who was at work. I think Chris then called the police, or actually, per maybe the documentary and Bailey Sarian, Chris was like, don't call the police. I'll be there, or some shit like that, right? Because immediately she's like, I want to call the police. Like, this is weird. And he was like, no, it's fine. Don't call the police. She's out on a play date and with another couple or something, or maybe they're at a park. But he like legit told Nicole, like, oh, no, I know where they are. They're on a play date. Nicole, having eyeballs, saw that the car was still in the garage with the two car seats and was like, no, their car is still here. And Shanann, I don't think, is gonna walk. Like, I don't think they lived anywhere close or something that they could just take the kids like on foot. So she called the police. So the officer then arrived to conduct a welfare check about 13:40. The police officer got on the phone with Chris and was like, hey, do I have your permission to go into the house? And I think Chris said, I'm on my way or whatever. He didn't let the police officer go in. He said, I'll be there to let you in. Chris arrived using the garage door. They went through and left. Ooh, you sneaky motherfucker. So Chris arrived home, right? And then entered the garage door while Nicole and the police officers were waiting outside for a few minutes. So it is thought that he may have been hiding some evidence, whatever it was, maybe cleaning up, putting stuff away. So you can see, actually, have you seen this, Nao, the body cam footage of this actual police walkthrough?
Yeah, and it's very, like, surreal. Mm-hmm. Because normally people, when, you know, they're kind of beside themselves when they can't help explain when a loved one is missing or they feel like something has gone very wrong. But the way he's behaving and, like, just really strange.
Mm-hmm.
So I know they had included that in the Netflix documentary.
Yeah.
Because not only that, everybody kind of picked up on it.
Yeah.
Right from the get-go, there was, like, there is something off here.
Right. And again, we don't, you know, we can't assume how one is going to react if we're missing, right? Or somebody's missing or something distressing is happening because our fight, flight, freeze, fawn response. But for him, he was eerily calm. I think that's what it was instead of, oh, maybe he's dissociating or in shock. Because you can kind of see when people are in shock, right? They're just like lost of words, like they don't know what to say, like they're distracted. But he was like very focused, but with no emotions, essentially. It was that very flat affect of walking the police officer around and pointing things out and almost like having an answer to everything, almost trying to convince the officer that, like, no, she did this. Like, he had like a narrative to everything. She told me she was gonna divorce. Oh my god, I found a ring, right? And they had the wedding ring was on the nightstand. So he was like, oh, I just found this, and you can see it in the body cam. Like, he's like, this is her wedding ring. Yeah, like, Nao's
making a face. Okay, sir, what? I thought you knew where she was. She was on a play date.
Thank you. Yeah. And all of a sudden now she's peaced out because she doesn't want to be with you anymore because you guys are going to divorce. Yeah. Like, there are a lot of holes in that story. As they did that, all her shit was still there, essentially, right? Like, her wallet, her purse, medication was all over the house. And also the phone was still there. And the dog seemed pissed. So I think that's a point we have to talk about. Yeah. So I think that same day, and you can see it in that documentary that Nao had mentioned. I forget what it's called. Something about Next Door or something. The neighbor was like, hey, I got some footage. Or, hey, can I help, I think, or something like that. And Chris was like, fuck. So the neighbor was like, hey, I have a ring cam. You want to check it out? And then the officer was like, hell yeah. So, again, still recorded on the body cam. So they go in and watch Chris's truck, like, reversed into the garage. And you can see he's loading stuff in. Whatever, Chris is there, he sees his reaction and blah, blah, blah. And then Chris leaves and the police officer hangs back a little bit. And the neighbor was like, yeah, that he's kind of weird. Like, he's acting weird. That's not him. They're like, oh, really? And I will say, like, his demeanor, I don't know Chris, right? I don't know him prior to this. So I don't know what his baseline is, but he seemed calm. He still seemed like calm baseline, but the neighbor was like, nah, he seemed nervous. Like, he kind of seemed off. So he's a real MVP also, knowing that. So yeah, he gave the police officer like the info about that. So then the next day, the FBI and the FBI Colorado Bureau of Investigation field office joined the investigation, and Chris continue to say he has no idea where they are. He hasn't seen his wife. He just continues to say he has no idea and gives interviews to a few networks to plead for their return. And you can see that also on YouTube and just his weird, stupid face.
I want to read first what he wrote in the letter because he kind of detailed a little bit more. But what he said was, I don't know if you want this in the book or if God does, but here are the things I left out. 1. August 12th, when I finished putting the girls to bed, I walked away and said, that's the last time I'm going to be tucking my babies in. I knew what was going to happen the day before, and I did nothing to stop it. I was numb to the entire world. I had literally taken my kids to a birthday party, played with water balloons, had an amazing time, sad songs all the way home, gave them a bath, a shower, ate dinner, read bedtime stories and sang bedtime songs. And still nothing registered. When Shanann had to be somewhere, I always enjoyed taking the girls places or playing outside because it was our opportunity to bond, and still, the night before, I couldn't stop myself from what I knew would occur the next morning. 2. August 13th, morning of. I went to the girls' room first, where Shanann and I had our argument. I went to Bella's room, then Cece's room, and used a pillow from their bed to kill them. That's why the cause of death was smothering. After I left Cece's room, then I climbed back in bed with Shanann, and our argument ensued. After Shanann had passed, Bella and Cece woke back up. I'm not sure how they woke back up, but they did. These poor babies, he tried to smother them, and then they woke up.
Jesus. They came back.
Bella's eyes were bruised, and both girls looked like they had been through trauma. That made the act that much worse, knowing I went into their rooms first, and knowing I still took their lives at the location of the batteries. And at this point, he's talking about, like, the oil field.
Fuck. So I didn't know that he tried to smother them at home. The only confession that I saw was the police confession that he had killed them at the oil field or the oil tank.
3. The reason the medical examiner found oxycodone in Shanann's system is because I gave it to her. I thought it would be easier to be with Nicole if Shanann wasn't pregnant. So throughout the book, he talks about how Shanann had complained about a headache, but he gave her oxycodone instead in hopes that it would make her miscarry. So he said, I don't know if this was a spiritual visit, but I had a dream Cece was dancing next to the chair in my cell. When she was dancing, all of my folders on the chair started moving, and I thought she was in trouble. So I said, watch out, get away, watch out. Then I woke up. I'm hoping she comes back. I hope everyone comes to visit me. I'm trying to see if I can clear my head better before I go to sleep to help.
No, I hope they haunt your ass and scratch you.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
Because, yeah, so... And there's more specific details that happen because it goes on to say that he eventually agreed to a plea deal, but he was still trying to hold up the story. And for some reason, he had asked to speak with his dad. And it was only after he spoke with his dad that he agreed to own up to things. Because initially, the story he had said was that he had murdered Shanann because she was the one that had murdered the children as a way of retaliation for him bringing up separation or divorce. But it was later found that he confessed to all of it. And so, according to this news article, in subsequent prison interviews that Chris Watts, it's reported that strangled Shanann in the bed. And this was after her arrival back home early in the morning. So shortly after she had come back from that business trip, he murdered her. It goes on to say that Watts tried to smother the children before Shanann had arrived home, but that they had woke up at some point, which is what he's referencing to. Once Shanann was strangled to death, he went ahead and wrapped her in a bedsheet and dragged her to his truck, which he had then reverse parked into their garage door. Chris Watts goes on to describe that her eyes had turned black with blood and her makeup ran and her bowels emptied in the bed when she had passed away. The autopsy revealed that Shanann, there was no signs of struggle, indicating that she was probably attacked while she was asleep and that she was rendered unconscious by pressure on her jugular vein. The article goes on to state that the children were then put in Watts' truck and spent the 40-mile trip with their dead mother in the vehicle before they were also strangled at the Anadarko facility. Bella, the oldest of the two, apparently tried to fight her smothering by Watts before she succumbed. And in the book, he talks about how out of all of them, Bella was the one that was the one that fought the hardest for her life. And I found that detail so disturbing for him to describe it that way. Because how dare you talk about a baby like that?
Like you're proud. Like you're a fucking proud parent. That's the feeling that I got, was like, oh, she was a fighter. Like there's this disconnect, like there's lack of, like a dissociative piece of like him, like it was his actions, right? He's saying the words and he's taking accountability, but just like, yeah, how do you even live with that?
So sadly, Shanann was found in a shallow grave in that work site that he had gone to. And then the children were found in, I forgot how they say it, but...
I think they're the oil tanks. They're in oil tanks.
I think they describe it as like a battery tank or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
there's so much coverage on it that they show the tanks from above.
And there's actually some news articles that talk about like the details of how the children were found, but it's actually really disturbing, tragic, and sad.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you want to go research on your own, it's just completely up to you. But it's really disturbing material. You know, one of the things that one of the articles had noted towards the end is that, kind of like we were saying, is that she was made aware about the separation that he was planning. She was made aware about the children, about his wife. And she did participate in extensive interviews in which she shared what she knew about Chris Watts and his current situation. And she actually rendered her phone over for inspection. It was found that on the night of the murders, Chris Watts and Nicole Kessinger had shared a 111-minute long phone call. The conversation ended at 23:19. And that is around the time that Shanann was originally supposed to have gone home, but I think there was a flight delay at that time. And so at this time, given all that information, it is believed that she ended her relationship with Watts after she had learned about what had happened, and that she is currently living under witness protection. According to reports, one source, and it's quoted, she has received several threats, public shaming, and could be considered one of the most hated women in America. She plans to start fresh with a new name, new town, and ultimately a new identity. You know, like the footage that when they had initially responded to the home to do a welfare check, and also the neighbor providing that his footage from his cameras. And so he is described as, so on August 13, 2018, he was sweating and looking nervous as Nate showed police and Watts CCTV from a camera installed by Nate looking directly into the Watts driveway. It's quoted that the officer watched on as Nate continued through the footage on his TV, trying to pinpoint the moment he recalls seeing Chris loading up his car at 5 a.m. Nate was suspicious as he noted it was unusual for Chris to be up so early, but also the car was in park in its usual spot. After he found a reason to leave the tense situation, Nate told the officer, "He's not acting right," and while looking completely unconvinced by Chris's version of the story.
Yeah. Good job, Nate. On August 15, 2018, Tammy Lee conducted an interview and polygraph tests with Chris Watts. Lee began the interview by saying that at the moment only one person in the room knew the truth, but the cool thing was that at the end of the test, two of them would know. That's like kind of a troll, and I'm here for it. So we have to remember, too, the polygraph test is not always conclusive, and there's a lot of discrepancies in it, and it's actually not, you, from my understanding, you can't use it in the court of law solely. Like, you have to have other, like, evidence and stuff, too. So, yeah, he failed it. So, basically, what Neo pointed out is that he did not, the normal score to indicate that someone is lying is around -4. Watts scored -18.
The machine knew.
And if someone scores 2 or higher, and if someone scores 2 or higher, they're probably telling the truth. So let me repeat that. Homeboy got -18. And after failing that,
the machine knew, the lady knew.
Yeah, she already knew. She's like, you fucking creep.
We knew. Nate knew.
Nicole knew. After failing, and you can see this in the footage of the police investigation or police interrogation, Watts requested to speak to his father and later confessed to his father about killing Shanann, but still said it was because Shanann killed the two girls. So still fully blaming Shanann for it. Ooh, that full interview with Tammy Lee lasted 7 hours, y'all. That's enough deterrent to not fucking kill somebody, right? Like, I don't want to be in interrogation for that long. Yikes. I mean, we can go into more about the interview, but there's just a lot of stuff that they had noted. Again, hindsight, like, he kept referring to his family as past tense. despite there being at the time no evidence that they were more than just missing persons, right? So they didn't know supposedly that they were dead yet, but he kept saying they were in sentences. So we know that he pleaded and confessed. So what would you call Chris Watts, essentially, right? Like, we have serial killers, mass murderers. He is considered a family annihilator. So what is family annihilation? And there's, Nao had mentioned prior to the starting, is that there is actually a lot of cases. We just don't hear about it. So many of the cases of family annihilation occurs in August before school starts, which may delay detection investigation. And another point was that premeditation, I think it was premeditation, didn't Chris call the girls' daycare to say that they weren't coming? That might have been before or after the death, right? Did he do that?
Ooh, I might have been missing that, but in the book he is quoting from his own letters, all the weeks of me thinking about killing Shanann, and I was faced with it.
I feel like he did that. Because another family annihilator did that too, though. So at 8:15 a.m. Monday, August 13th, hours before he reportedly knew his family was missing, Watts called Primrose School, where his elder daughter was supposed to be starting kindergarten that day. He told an employee that his children would no longer be attending the school because his family was moving. And he then asked, "They are not there, are they?" The FBI's Graham Coder brought up the conversation in an August 14th interview with Watts, who then tried to recast it. So this is, I'm going to go back and forth. Question: tell me about the call to your daycare. To Primrose, I called them to see if the girls were there. They said they weren't there. Okay. I told them since they weren't there to put them back on the waiting list. That's not what you told them. Chris, I told them that we were going to sell the house, put it on the market. We probably won't be in the area anymore. That's two different things, Chris. Chris says, well, I want them to be back on. I put them on the waiting list as they weren't there. Question: why weren't they there? Answer: I don't know. Question: where were they gonna go? Answer: they went to Shanann took them to a friend's house. Question: why wouldn't they go to daycare? I'm not sure. I honestly, sir, I'm not sure. This is investigator. It's hard for me as a father to talk to you like this. FBI investigator was not having it with this dude. Yeah, so yeah, so he did fucking call. Sorry, went on a tangent. I just had to.
No, but it's true. You know how we were saying earlier, like, the author goes on to say that Chris Watts has an IQ of 140. There's no source. I don't know if they kind of put, like, an official source because we couldn't even find, like, a psych eval for him. But the author did notate mm-hmm. for someone that mm-hmm. has that kind of high IQ, he lacks a lot of common sense. And so,
right.
That's so bizarre.
Yeah, so, right, which also really comes into the narcissistic personality of, like, this grandiose sense of self that you're smarter than everybody and you're one step ahead. So yeah, he had a step ahead to call, but hey, dummy, you called before you supposedly knew what happened. So yeah, that was off of the tangent of that they found research where, or they did a research and study that a lot of the deaths happen in August before school starts. And according to former FBI profiler Candace DeLong, cases such as Watts are rare because family annihilators usually commit suicide after the murders, end quote. Which is usually an action that is from guilt for their actions, right? A study has been published that analyzes three decades of criminal records of British murder cases, drawing up psychological profiles of the four types of men who kill members of their own families. Family annihilators have received little attention as a separate category of the killer, says Professor David Wilson, one of the paper's three authors and the director of the Center of Applied Criminology at Birmingham City University. Newspaper articles from 1980 to 2012 were used to find and analyze cases from the study. Of the 71 family annihilators identified for the study, 59 of them were male, and 55% of them were in their 30s when they committed the crime. The frequency with which these kind of murder cases are occurring is also increasing, the study found. Oh, hell no. Over half of the murders that were identified took place between 2000 and 2010. Quote unquote, ordinary family men could do quite extraordinarily appalling things to their partners, ex-partners, and their children. Family annihilators were overwhelmingly not known to criminal justice or mental health services. They were usually holding down good jobs. Family breakup, including related issues such as access to children, was the most common cause for family murders, followed by financial troubles, honor killings, and mental illness. 81% of men who killed members of their family attempted to kill themselves afterwards. People who are murdered usually have some kind of existing relationship with their murderer, and those who committed family annihilation were in no way typical murderers. Examining all the cases led to the identification of four distinct characteristics that drove the murderer, which helps to dismantle the common myth that family killings are motivated either by revenge or altruism. So these are the different types. Self-righteous killers hold the mother responsible for the breakdown of the family, will often call her before to explain what he is about to do, which is John Battaglia. Disappointed killers believe their family has let them down. The killing could be sparked by something like children not choosing to follow religious customs. Anomic killers see the family as a symbol of their own economic success, but if they suffer some kind of economic failure, for example, bankruptcy, the family no longer serves this function. And then paranoid killers are often motivated by a desire to protect their family from a perceived threat, such as having children taken away by social services. Most family annihilators fell into the self-righteous or anomic categories, whilst those who were self-righteous were often histrionic and dramatic, choosing significant dates such as Father's Day to commit their crimes. It's clear that it's men that usually resort to this type of violence, and these four characteristics are closely related to a man's idea about gender roles and his family or his place within the family. Interestingly, Chris Watts does not fit into any of these four categories associated with family annihilators. Normally, someone who wants to leave their partner divorces them rather than killing the whole family. Murdering his wife and children seems crazy for Chris Watts. He contacted the school on the morning of the murders to say that they were leaving the area and immediately got on selling the house. He seemed to be completely naive that leaving his wife in a shallow grave, leaving evidence like the phone and medication in the house, would not lead investigators immediately to Chris Watts.
And we're not diagnosing him, or we don't have any history of his mental health or anything like that. But it makes you wonder, like, how some people behave and respond to certain situations and then believe they can somehow get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if he had pre-contemplating for, like, weeks. There was already, like, premeditation to that. It's kind of like almost like Jody.
Yeah, I will say, though, I do appreciate this article about the family annihilator and, like, how they break it down, but I will disagree. Let me know what you think, Nao, about him not fitting into one of those categories, because I feel like he's a self-righteous killer. Not in regards of, like, holding the mother responsible for the breakdown, but, like, he was putting it on her that she wasn't the woman for him anymore, you know?
Yeah, and actually one of the points of contention was that I think eventually her suspicions have risen to possible extramarital affair, because I think in a message she says, like, she better be worth it.
She was catching on, but he kept denying and thinking that smarter than that. I'm not diagnosing him formally, and I'm not saying this to justify it, but he seems to hit the criteria for narcissistic personality disorder. And we also know that, like, domestic violence perpetrators often have those tendencies too, right? Because there's no empathy, there's such a sense of entitlement and arrogance behaviors and attitudes. And also, I think for him, he was preoccupied with fantasies of this ideal relationship that he had with Nicole. Looking at this timeline, they were only dating for like a month or two. So, but they had been family issues prior to that. So I wonder, like, that his relationship with Nicole was just, like, the straw that broke the camel's back in regards of him acting on this. I think he was too much of a coward to even have any confrontation with Shanann that he wasn't happy.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it kind of gave him a taste of what life could be.
Like, without the girls, yeah.
There's, like, the anomic one, right? And mm-hmm. granted, the only sign of financial struggles that we know is about the bankruptcy. Because the picture that they were both given to the public was that it was the...
perfect.
The perfect family next door with the white picket fence.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if that was also, like, another point of contention or kind of, like, a dab to the ego, maybe.
Right. Yes, exactly. That it was, like, a failure on their end. And then also... there was, I forget, either Bailey, you know, or the Netflix documentary that talked about how there was a lot of conflict between them because Shanann was trying to keep up with the Joneses in buying stuff and vacations, and, like, they had a lot of debt because of her being in the MLM business, that he didn't want to spend that much money and didn't care about it. So on top of that, I think there was a lot of tension with the finances. Yeah, it's so not fucking necessary for him to have murdered those three beautiful people.
You know, rest in peace to Shanann, baby Cece, and baby Bella. From what they showed in the content of social media, like, they were happy babies.
Mm-hmm.
They would show, like, posts like one of the babies singing a song about their dad, and, you know, Shanann praising him as a father, as a husband, like, them playing with their dad. And so it's just very tragic and awful what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
Rest in peace to them. Chris Watts is going to serve 5 life sentences consecutively without the chance of parole. Even at that, he's still making marks on the media. I think even up to this year, they're talking about how people sent him, like, fan mail and pictures in bikinis and things like that. And we've talked about this before, where there's a... I forget in which podcast we cover this, in which, like, women send people that have murdered others. They send them, like, also, like, fan mail. And I think Ted Bundy's one of them.
Well, Casey Anthony. Yeah, Ted Bundy for sure. Casey Anthony had, like, some fan club when she was in jail. Yeah.
But thank you guys for tuning in. If you have any questions or you have any comments or feedback to us, please let us know. We appreciate you tuning in. Till next time, homies.
Keep it real.
Peace.
Thank you for joining us, and be sure to come back next week where we continue to explore true crime, psychology, the paranormal, mental health, and everything in between. We would love to hear from you, so email us at millennialtherapistspod@gmail.com with your ghost stories, paranormal experiences, questions about therapy and counseling, or the social work field. And don't forget to share, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Remember, you are valued, you are enough,
and you are not alone.
Please subscribe and review. Bye-bye.
Although we are licensed mental health therapists and may cover therapy-related subjects, the topics in this podcast should not substitute professional, psychological, or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
If you are a victim of a crime, which includes but not limited to stalking, human trafficking, financial crimes, or sexual assault, please know the Victim Connect Resource Center can help. They are a referral helpline where crime victims can learn about their rights and options confidentially and compassionately. A traditional telephone-based helpline is 1-855-4-VICTIM or 1-855-484-2846. Or you can connect with them at chat.victimconnect.org or at the website victimconnect.org.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, whether they are considering suicide or not, please call the toll-free lifeline available 24/7 across the United States by calling 1-800-273-8255. 8255 or visit suicidepreventionlifeline.org. U.S. and Canadian listeners can also text HOME to 741-741 to connect with a trained crisis counselor. UK listeners text HOME to 852-58 and Ireland listeners text HOME to 50808.
For more mental health resources and support, international listeners can visit the website unitedgmh.org/mental-health-support to find more mental health services and resources.
And if you are a veteran in crisis or concerned about one, connect with the Veteran Crisis Line to reach caring, qualified responders with the Department of Veterans Affairs at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1, or text 838-255. Or you can always visit veteranscrisisline.net.
If you or anyone you know may be experiencing domestic violence, you can find resources and support with the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Visit thehotline.org or call 1-800-799-7233.